Good afternoon. Calling State Affairs to order Tuesday, May 4, 2021, 3:06 p.m. Members present from my left to my right, Representatives Vance, Kaufman, Story, Claim, and myself, Chair Chris Tompkins, and with five members present, that constitutes a quorum. Other representatives in the room, Representative Carpenter and Senator Begich and Representative Shragi, welcome. Thank you, as always, to Sophia, who's online listening with House Records, and Tom in the back of the room with LIO for facilitating today's meeting. And we have 6 pieces of legislation on today's agenda, and it is my goal and intent to get through all of them. So there are a couple of amendments and a couple of discharges that we'll be taking up, but we'll take them in order. And the first bill on the agenda is House Bill 163, is the third hearing, but it is a formality, I would say, because we were not able to conduct public testimony because of a telecommunications outage previously. And let the record reflect Representative Eastman joined us at 3:07. So at this point in time, I'm going to open public testimony for House Bill 163. I'm looking online. I'm seeing no one here to testify. I'm looking in the room, and I see no one here to testify. I'm going to close public testimony and see if there are any committee comments before we entertain a motion for discharge. Seeing none, Representative Clayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to report House Bill 163, version 32-LS0666/A, out of committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note.
Seeing and hearing no objection, House Bill 163 moves from committee. Thank you, Representative Shragi.
Thank you.
The next item on today's agenda is the CS for Senate Bill 28, Senate State Affairs, establishing Alaska Constitution Day. Here to present the legislation, Senator Begich and Lockie Gill-Tobin. Welcome to the House, and welcome to House State Affairs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Begich, Senate District J, Anchorage. Very happy to be in the House. It's a nice, calm environment. Appreciate that. Plus, it also got me out of Senate Hess Committee. Very quickly, just to reiterate, SB 28 establishes Alaska Constitution Day. There's really only two sections, one that established this as one of the regular commemorated holidays, not a legal holiday, but a commemorated holiday, and then sets an effective date of July 1st. On April 24th, 1956, which is some 65 years ago, the citizens of Alaska ratified the Constitution of the State of Alaska. In doing so, they guaranteed that the individual will always be in charge. That's a quote from the Constitutional Convention. It enshrined our state's values of individual freedom, local control, and personal autonomy at the core of our statehood. The purpose of our Constitution was to, again quoting from the Constitutional Convention, transmit to succeeding generations our heritage of political, civil, and religious liberty within the United States, end quote. Over the past 65 years, the Constitution has remained relevant and true. Our state's constitutional delegates provided through this document a visionary template for guided governance that has served us very, very well. We built it on the constitutions of all the other states, and as such, it really is a model constitution for the rest of the country. Now it's time to recognize the persistence of our Constitution by establishing an annual reminder and celebration of the continuity of our state's values. Senate Bill 28 provides a bridge from the past to the future by establishing the Vic Fisher and Jack Cockill Constitution of the State of Alaska Day. The reason we've identified the last two surviving members, and of course we lost Senator Coghill, former Lieutenant Governor Coghill, some 2 years ago. We still have Vic Fisher with us, but we're honoring these two who represented different political perspectives as really an encapsulation of the essence of our Constitution. Two people who came from different perspectives but worked together to ensure the state would work seamlessly and together the state would work well. If we are going to know where we're going, we have to know where we came from. We have to better attend to where and what we've done. We're coming out of recovery right now from an unprecedented pandemic. We face fiscal instability, but for a moment, let's reflect on why we're here in the first place. That's what this bill intends to do. I've already given you the sectional analysis, Mr. Chairman, in my opening comments, and I'm open for questions. And I would mention that there is a special person online, to a special invited testifier, and I'm also available to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Senator Begich. And just for the committee's reference, as the committee knows, it's always been my practice to have two hearings, the second hearing being for public testimony, except in special circumstances, and this is one of those. So I'm hoping to discharge the bill today after considering public and invited testimony. I think there's a certain timeliness and importance with this bill, and just wanted to sort of share that thinking with the committee's reference. But questions from the committee for the sponsor? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Senator, and through the chair. Now, you recognize two of the 55 constitutional delegates, and I assume it's your intention that this bill and this statute will live on after we no longer have any delegates with us. And at that point, I think the question will be asked by some, what about the other 53 delegates? And so would you have any objection to also including with your bill a recommendation, I guess, to the state that we honor all 55 of our constitutional delegates?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, it's a pleasure to answer that question. It's come up twice before, once on the floor of the Senate and once in the State Affairs Committee. First thing I would say is that the beauty of having named two, it's led to, both in the Senate State Affairs Committee and on the floor, for people actually acknowledging and naming all the rest as part of the celebratory nature. Because what it does is it prompts exactly the questions you've asked. And certainly recommending in the bill, I would entertain that certainly as something that we could do or add to the bill if that were necessary. But I think the very nature of the two being named poses exactly that question, and that is why it's been asked every time it's been presented. And I think, Representative Eastman, I absolutely understand your intent with doing that, and I certainly, you, in the statute, in the way the statute's written, you don't actually lay out provisions for how you execute each of these days. It just names the commemorating day. But what we're doing right this moment, on the record, is reminding people of how we should honor it. And I would recommend also, if it does get to the floor, that if we're lucky enough to have it come to the floor of the State House, that also be put on the record, that those 55 other names be actually mentioned, be actually spoken, as Senator Costello did in our body. She went through each of them, and I'd be happy to provide that data. But I think the exact nature of your question, Representative Eastman, I keep wanting to call you Senator Eastman, I hope that's okay. The exact nature of your question prompts the answer, and that it would be my hope that that's how it would be celebrated. To put that in the actual statute would be unusual, because none of the other commemorated days have that kind of how we should celebrate, but that's exactly what the record would show.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
And I think many of us who are younger recognize the distinction of these two former delegates by virtue of their having lived longer than the rest. Are there other reasons that cause you to select these two in particular?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, exactly the comments I was making earlier. These two came from very different perspectives, Representative Eastman. And both you and I and other members of both bodies have faced disagreements and found moments of agreement. These two found, as they went through life, because of their shared lived experience with the Constitution, they role model how those who come from one perspective and those who come from another perspective work together. And they do so truly better than anyone I can imagine in the state today. And it's virtually because of their relationship to our founding document that they were able to find that common ground.
Thank you.
Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins. For the record, Representative Story, and welcome Senator Begich and Ms. Tobin to the House. It's good to see you. And this, I know your passion for education, and this certainly strikes me as something that complements civics education for our youth and all of us, actually, in the state. So I appreciate that. You had said something about it being a commemorative holiday. I see it as a legal holiday in the documents, if I'm following that correctly, so can help me. I'll follow that because it doesn't have a fiscal note, and I was wondering if it was to be considered a holiday, if we would, how that is looked upon for our state employees and the rest of our employees.
Thank you, Representative Story. Through the chair to Representative Story. The version you should be looking at is the state affairs version, which ensures that it will be a commemorative and not a legal holiday. And I think that's critical because, of course, of the fiscal impact of a legal holiday. Being a commemorative holiday puts it in good company with a number of other holidays that we've recognized in this state, and that would prompt and prompt both the commemoration and, as you point out, it says observed at school assemblies and by suitable observances and exercises by civic groups in the public. That's common language to other commemorative holidays, and so it is in the commemorative holiday section of our statutes is where this would be established, not in the legal holiday section of our statutes, and there are two different sections, 4412-137, 4412 in the area that deals with 137 is where the commemorative holidays are. It's a special article within our statute books.
Thank you for that explanation, and I see that I was not following along on the right Senate bill, state affairs, so thank you for that.
Thank you, Representative Story. Representative Eastman, I think no one else in the queue.
First,
it's all you.
I have a motion. I would like to look at page 1, line 7, and consider a conceptual amendment, and that would simply to add the words, and all of Alaska's constitutional delegates. And so that if the amendment passed, it would read Vic Fisher and Jack Coghill Constitution of the State of Alaska Day is established on April 24th of each year to honor Jack Coghill and Vic Fisher and all of Alaska's constitutional delegates and commemorate the creation of the Constitution of the State of Alaska.
I'll object for discussion.
There's an objection, Senator Begich.
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I would consider that a friendly amendment, and I would just add that you, I think, want to say Jack Coghill and Vic Fisher, comma, and so you'd want to put the comma in there. But I think that's a friendly amendment. I think it would capture the spirit of what this bill is intended to do, and I would appreciate very much if the committee would consider that.
Thank you, and I would like to amend my motion to add a comma.
Okay, there's a conceptual amendment to the conceptual amendment, and I didn't hear an objection, so we'll consider that amendment to the amendment. Passed. Is there discussion on the conceptual amendment from the committee?
I would remove my objection to the, well, actually let the discussion.
I think we're good on the objection.
So I would just note that rather than try to be perfect grammatical engineers in committee, that we actually let Ledge Legal figure out the best way to write that, because I think the intent is clear from the proposed amendment, but with that comment that we should not interfere with Ledge Legal getting the best way to write it, I will withdraw my objection.
And is there any further objection to conceptual amendment number one? Seeing and hearing none, the amendment is adopted, and the CS to Senate Bill 28 stands before us amended, and I would just echo Representative Klayman's comments that Ledge Legal has the prerogative to make all conforming stylistic and other incorporations into the final CS coming out of committee. Senator Begich, further comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have to make a comment. We were sitting here in my former employer's room named after my former employer, Max Gruenberg, and he would have appreciated the fact that we are debating a conceptual amendment and a comma, both of which, if for those who knew Max, would have amused him. Thank you.
Absolutely. I would just echo that as a State Affairs Committee disciple of Max Gruenberg in my first term or two. I was certainly can identify with that comment. Any further questions from the committee for the sponsor? Well, seeing none, it appears that we have an invited testifier who has appeared online, Mr. Vic Fisher. If you can hear us, welcome to the committee. And please go ahead and put yourself on record and share any testimony you wish to share.
Thank you. I think this is a very good bill, and it will serve an important purpose. I have in my long life spoken to many high school students and college students about the Constitution. They've always been interested in what was special, and what I have emphasized, and that this bill would promote, is understanding among our people of the rights and the rights that they have under the Constitution and the privacy provisions and other provisions that Hello, are you still there?
Oh, you just, the line went quiet there for a second, but we can hear you now.
I just want to strongly support this because it's probably an opportunity to have the citizens of Alaska understand all the rights and obligations that they have under the Constitution. I commend your committees and the legislators for promoting this particular idea. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fisher, for those words. Any questions from the committee for our invited testifier? And just let the record reflect, Representative Tarr joined us at 3:22 p.m. Representative Klayman.
Not a question, but just wanted to say, Vic, thank you very much for testifying today. Thank you for your continued participation in this important democratic process and your long commitment to our state.
And thank you for your good work.
Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins, Rep Story for the record. And I, too, Mr. Fisher, wanted to just make a comment and thank you for taking the time to phone in today. It is really good to hear what you feel strikes at the heart of our Constitution and the rights and obligations that we have. So I just thank you very much for your work so many years ago that just rings true today. It's an honor to have you here.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments from the committee? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Representative Tarr, and I guess I just don't want to miss the opportunity. Even though I came in late, I will go back and listen, but it's so special that we have someone among us that helped frame our Constitution and can help us understand and try to keep us on track, and it'll be very special to have this recognition. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just add, one of my mentors was Senator Fisher, who in 1983 hired me to help him write campaign finance reform work as one of my first jobs working within the structure of the legislature. And so for me, it's full circle.
Thank you, Senator Begich. And I would just add that I think it's remarkable at age 97 that we have one of our founding fathers who's able to sort of share his perspective, and also just what an extraordinary life, from living in Nazi Germany to exposure to Stalinist Russia, incorporating those like worldly life experiences into writing our Constitution. And I would just add that per Representative Eastman's questions and your responses, Senator Begich, the model of Jack Coghill and Vic Fisher working together and, you know, finding common ground where appropriate is something I think is we're all do well to remember and be reminded of. Well, I see no further questions from the committee. I do want to open public testimony, as was noticed, and I don't see anybody in the room, and I don't see anyone in additional testifiers online, so I'm going to close public testimony. and bring the legislation back before the committee. I'd like to add there's a 5 p.m. amendment deadline yesterday, and no amendments were submitted. Of course, we have now conceptually amended the legislation, but is there any closing comment from the committee for Senate Bill 28? Representative Eastman.
Yes, I would just like to take the moment for purposes of the legislative record to mark that it is April 24th because in the constitutional process, it's not the elected officials who have the final say in whether or not a constitution is adopted. And on April 24th, the people of Alaska voted to give their consent to this constitution, which made it come into legal effect as a constitution. And I think that it's very appropriate that we have chosen April 24th in their honor, not to take away from our delegates and the hard work that they did in drafting it. But that was on behalf of the people. And if the people had said no, then we would have been back to the drawing board and we would have had to come up with something that met their approval.
Noted. Thank you, Representative Eastman. Further comments from the committee before we entertain a motion? Representative Clayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to report CS for Senate Bill 28, State Affairs, version 32-LS02781/I, as amended, out of committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note.
Seeing and hearing no objection, the CS for House Bill 28, Senate State Affairs, as conceptually amended, moves from committee. Thank you very much, Senator Begich, Ms. Tobin, and also Mr. Fisher online. And we'll circulate the paperwork as we proceed with today's agenda. The next and third item on today's agenda is House Joint Resolution 7 relating to constitutional amendments as far as the permanent fund and PFDs go. This is the governor's legislation. This is the second hearing. We have with us Mike Barnhill, if any burning questions arise. The purpose of today's hearing for HJR 7, as well as its companion legislation, HB 73, is public testimony, which was noticed. So it's my intent to hear public testimony. Ideally not get into the meat and potatoes of the bill. We'll have an opportunity to do that on Thursday. And I think all members are in receipt of the amendment deadline of Wednesday at 5 p.m. for both pieces of legislation. But with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn to public testimony. We'll go with the two pieces of legislation in the order I described. So we'll start with HJR 7, and I will open public testimony. Online, we have Bert, and forgive me if I mispronounce the last name, Houtelin in Big Lake. If you can hear us, Bert, please go ahead and put yourself on record and present your testimony in 3 or less minutes.
Present myself and about 4,000 Alaskans for what I have to say. I am against HJR 7 and presented first to the House right on a full display.
I don't think I can understand.
Yeah. Coming through so well.
Bert, it's a little bit choppy. Sounds like it might be a suspect cell connection. If there's anything you can do on your end to change things up, please feel free to try and we can give it another shot.
Give me just a second here.
And for what it's worth, that sounded a little bit more clear.
Is that better for it?
We think so.
Okay, my name is Bert Houtelin. I represent myself, my child, and about 4,000 Alaskans. I am in opposition of HJR 7. There is nothing in there that protects the statutory PFD as we have known it. In fact, it just makes it easier for you as the legislators to spend the money on the state and capital budget without no regards to us Alaskans and our statutory PFD. Anything that is not supporting our statutory PFD, I will always and always have been 100% against, and so are those who follow me. 4,000 plus Alaskans, or the 650,000 Alaskans approximately that have filed for their PFD, would definitely be against the making of formulation of this bill being pushed through if they were to actually understand what is written in it and the way it is. Please reject this bill. Stop it going through the committees. if you want to have a bill that actually does something that is going to protect our permanent fund dividends within the Constitution of Alaska, I suggest that you seriously take a hard look at SJR1 and fully incorporate that into any plans that you have into the future. It is the only bill that both protects you as the legislators for what you want to be able to spend on the state and capital budget, but it also protects our statutory PFD to be paid out first. With that particular bill, the statutory PFD, it also uses the 5% POMP draw in the formula, but the way it is written, the statutory PFD would be first paid from that draw, and all remaining amount of money would go to you as the legislators to spend as you wish. As the corpus and the ERA begins to grow larger and larger and larger, so would the permanent fund dividends coming to us Alaskans, and so would be the draw that you guys get to use. Anything other than that at this point is a no-go. I am a resounding no for this bill. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you for taking the time to testify. I don't see any. Oh, there is a question from the committee, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The gentleman was saying that he represents some thousands of Alaskans, and I just was curious in what capacity he meant that.
Mr. Houdelein.
I run a news organization page out here in Alaska and am directly involved with many committees that are within my regional area throughout the state. And everybody that is following my page, I have a 99% following that is Alaskan-based. And I have been asked on numerous occasions to also speak for all of them.
Okay. Thank you. And could you say your last name just once more so I can get it through my thick skull and pronounce it right?
How telling.
Great. Thank you, because I think we're going to be hearing from you again shortly. Well, I don't see. Oh, I do see another question from the committee, Representative Klayman.
Just to follow up on Representative Tarr's question, are you saying that you represent all Alaskans who receive a permanent fund dividend, or just the Alaskans that follow your communications?
Well, I personally represent 650,000 Alaskans that receive their dividend, because most of them don't even know this committee hearing is even happening right now. But the ones that I truly represent are the 4,000 that follow me, because I know how they feel directly.
I would just note for the record that I am one of the 650,000 Alaskans that receive a dividend, and he does not represent me.
Noted. Further questions from the committee? I don't see any. Thank you, Mr. Houdelein, for your testimony. And I don't see anyone else online, and I don't see anyone in the room. So at this time, I'm going to close public testimony in HJR 7. And that takes us to the companion legislation of HB 73, also from the governor. And at this time, I'm going to open public testimony in HB 73. We'll start with Adam Sykes in Homer. Adam Hikes in Homer. If you can hear us, please go ahead and put yourself on record and present your testimony in 3 or fewer minutes.
My name is Adam Hikes. I live in Homer, Alaska, and I represent myself and my wife because she is out running errands at the moment, couldn't be with us. I really appreciated the advisory note on this piece of legislation that would put it before the voters of Alaska, in which case I would absolutely vote no to end the 50-50 split on the already 75-25 split on Alaskan royalties. I've been against that from the beginning. And somebody mentioned that Thursday there would be a second chance to get into the nuts and bolts of this bill, but I looked on the LIO schedule, and it doesn't look like there's public testimony for that day. So may I ask a question about the nuts and bolts?
Mr. Hikes, you can present whatever testimony you please in these 3 minutes. I can clarify the question you just addressed when you're done, though.
Okay. When I read the word appropriation in this bill, it brings to mind a legislative budgetary appropriation, which I believe is so, so far from what Governor Hammond and all of the other people who created this permanent fund dividend intended for this. I don't know if that's what you mean by the word appropriation. But if so, then I would have to severely oppose this bill, and I think it's completely unfair what has been done to the permanent fund dividend without a vote of the people. That's all.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hikes, for your testimony. And I can clarify in the meat and potatoes comment. What I meant was, by that was for committee members who might have questions for representatives from the administration, that as we consider the legislation further on Thursday, we'll sort of dig
actually,
into the policy.
I'm sorry, I forgot to say one thing.
Please go ahead. I still have you at a minute 50, so in theory you have 70 more seconds.
It is section 2, page 2, that I specifically object to. I do not like the use of, pardon, the replacement wording from corporations shall transfer to legislature may appropriate, as if it were their money to begin with. I think it's just appalling. I believe it's managed by a separate corporation to keep it out of the hands of the legislature should they ever choose that it's not in Alaskans' best interest to receive a dividend that year, and leaving it to their whim, I believe that is completely contrary to the intent and the idea behind it, and I think that should be amended right out of it. That is all.
Thank you, Mr. Hikes, for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Hikes, for taking the time to testify. And Bert Hautelling is also in the queue for HB 73, but it looks like he may have just gone offline. So we won't be hearing from him again. I don't see anyone else in the queue for House Bill 73 testimony. So at this time, I'm going to close public testimony. And that takes the bill back before the committee. As stated before, 5 p.m. amendment deadline tomorrow, and we'll consider amendments on the Thursday hearing and potentially look to the will of the committee for final consideration on both pieces of legislation. So that concludes consideration of House Bill 73, the fourth item on today's agenda. And that takes us to the fifth item, House Bill 124 from Representative Carpenter. This is a first hearing for the legislation, albeit a second time it's been noticed, and we're glad to have the opportunity to take it up. Representative Carpenter and Mr. Best, welcome to the committee, and please present the legislation at your leisure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for scheduling this again. I know we had some conflicting schedules before, and I appreciate you hearing it, scheduling it again. And through the chair, for the record, my name is Representative Ben Carpenter. I'd like to do a quick introduction to the bill and then hand off to my staff member, Richard Best, for the sectional. And then I'll be available for any questions you might have. Before I get to the prepared statements, I'd just like to say that the impetus for this bill came last summer when we lost Representative Gary Knopp from District 30, which is adjoining to my district to the south, during a very difficult time in the state where we're dealing with a COVID fallout. And I think my office and potentially Representative Vance's office fielded the questions from District 30 as to what's going on. Benefits, unemployment insurance questions, all of those types of things that were addressing each one of our offices, there was no representation in District 30 to deal with that. And so we filled the gap as we should have done. And that was the impetus for taking a look at what's going on here. It was much later that there was actually representation for that district, and that's why we have this bill before us. So HB 124, ambiguity exists in the statute AS 1540-320 regarding the exceptions for filling vacancies in the state legislature within 30 days. This ambiguity led to the 2020 District 30 vacancy taking 171 days to be filled. And since statehood, Alaskans have gone without representation in the House of Representatives 21 times because of various delays in the process. HB 124 clarifies the process by rewriting the statute to more clearly communicate the exceptions to the 30-day appointment requirement. AS 1540-320 clearly indicates that quote, when a vacancy occurs in the state legislature, the governor within 30 days shall appoint a qualified person to fill the vacancy, end quote. The next sentence in that statute provides two exceptions and a qualifying statement to the governor's 30-day appointment requirement. The first exception refers to the expiration of the remainder of the predecessor's term, and the second exception refers to Senate vacancies filled by special election. The qualifying statement refers to the legislature meeting, convening, or reconvening. The ambiguity exists because of individual interpretation of whether the qualifying statement refers to both exceptions or just one exception. And that one exception would be the second one. Governor Dunleavy's reasoning for not appointing a replacement for District 30 was that he did not have the authority to make the appointment because the term of office would expire before the next legislature would meet, convene, or reconvene. It's my position that the qualifying statement should refer only to the second exception because the qualifying statement's impact on the first exception would be to negate the first requirement to fill the vacancy within 30 days. It may be argued that the vacancy appointment provision was only intended to ensure representation during a legislative session, but I believe that position would not be in the best interest of the people and is counter to our representative form of government. The duties and salary of a representative continue during the interim between legislative sessions, and the oath of office we take applies to the entire term of office. There's clear intent that the framers of our representative form of government intended for continuous representation from each district in our state legislature. HB 124 restructures the statute to add clarity and adds additional language within 30 days after the vacancy occurs to more clearly communicate that the exception to the 30-day requirement only applies to appointments where the predecessor's term will expire within those 30 days. The additional language will result in a requirement for the governor to submit a vacancy appointment within 30 days unless the vacancy occurs in the 30 days preceding the start of the first session of a new legislature. HB 124 restructures but does not change the statute pertaining to filling Senate vacancies. Now I'll turn this over to Richard.
Through the chair, Richard, for the record, Richard Best, staff to Representative Carpenter. Got the sectional analysis that was included in your packet, and it's fairly simple. We look at Alaska Statute 1540.320, and it deletes language line 6 through 10. It adds language on line 10, and then we're adding subsection 1, lines 11 through 12, and adding subsection 2, lines 13 through 14.
Thank you.
That concludes my comments, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Let's open it up for questions. Questions from the committee. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and to the sponsor, through the chair. What would your intent be for situations like occurred 2 years ago where an elected legislator resigns or is otherwise unavailable in those last 30 days of the term? So the elections happened, someone was elected, they're not going to be the legislator at that point, but it's within 30 days. What should happen with that time?
Thank you. And through the chair to Representative Eastman, I believe that the intent of the statute with the requirement for 30 days, but then an exception exists, means that within those 30 days, the mechanics of getting somebody situated in new office when there's going to be a new legislature start means that it would be acceptable to not have representation for those 30 days. And HB 124 would keep that or would make that more clear. So in the instance of what happened 2 years ago, there wouldn't be an appointment with 124. There wouldn't be an appointment within those 30 days. And the new legislator that was duly elected would be seated with the process of the new legislature, if that answers your question.
Follow up.
Well, actually, the scenario I'm envisioning is that the new legislator can't be sitted because the elected legislator is not available. The term of office is going to expire in 30 days, so you're not able to appoint anyone. So you literally have to wait until the time expires, and then on that first day of the session, you can perhaps then appoint someone. And I'm just wondering, is there a public benefit in basically requiring, in those hopefully rare situations, that no one can be appointed, even though, you know, you're going to end up appointing the same person?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I guess if the mechanics of appointing someone were as simple as the governor picking a name, and I know that there's a process here for appointments that isn't covered in 124, which includes communication and decisions from the district from which the appointment would come from, and then decisions from within the legislature on approval of appointments, and that has nothing to do here. All of that, if that took place within a couple days, then I guess maybe we don't need a 30-day exception that's currently in the statute. But I think the reality is this process is slow and onerous sometimes, and that 30-day window is just given to afford us the opportunity to things just don't work really smoothly and quickly as we would want them. And so there's that 30-day acknowledgement that it is going to take some time. And if it's not within that time, then we don't need to have an appointment for that time period. It'll correct itself given the new legislature.
Additional questions from the committee? Representative Klayman.
So on the 30-day timeline, I understand the 30-day timeline to be the practical reality that Representative Knopp dies, and it just takes the governor a little while to get names and submit those names, and so that 30 days is the practical timeline, and not trying to give a deadline that's too quick or too slow, and that if you've got to give them 30 days to pick somebody, how can you make him pick somebody if there's only 30 days left? So is that your understanding of the 30 days, or do you understand that differently?
Through the chair to Representative Klayman, no, that's exactly right. In Representative Knopp's case, 30 days went by, and then there was no nominee. So that's what is being addressed here, is that there can't be an interpretation of the statute that allows the governor in the process to not have a nominee for 171 days.
Follow up.
So in the case of Representative Knopp, do you have any idea why somebody from the Kenai didn't sue the governor, basically saying you didn't appoint somebody in 30 days, appoint somebody now? Because there were certainly a lot more than 30 days between his death and the next election. Any idea why no one sued? Because that would have resolved the statutory interpretation question that we're talking about.
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Klayman, I don't know the why there wasn't anybody that sued. I guess I could take a swag and say that we had other things that were taking our attention at the time with the COVID crisis. And I know I come from a fairly conservative district that doesn't like suing people. And so those would be two guesses on my part. But I don't know. I certainly didn't have any conversations with anybody as to why they did or did not sue. So,
follow up.
In the materials that you provided on page 2 of your sponsor statement, you say there's clear intent from the framers of the, or I think the sentence reads, there's clear intent that framers of our representative form of government intended for continuous representation from each district in our state legislature. Where do you find that in the framers' documents? Because you didn't attach that portion, and so whenever I see clear intent, I'm curious the foundation for that.
So as I said through the chair to Representative Klayman, the clear intent in my part is to the specific statute that currently exists that says when a vacancy occurs in the legislature, the governor within 30 days shall appoint a qualified person to fill a vacancy. The clear intent being there that under normal circumstances, we need to fill vacancies. And then there's some exceptions to why that wouldn't happen. And that's where the ambiguity exists, and I think it just needs to be clarified that it's not, it shouldn't be, as I said earlier, what was it, 71 times? 21 times that there was delay. And I think you've got attached in your packet for supporting documentation of a chart from our legislative research division that shows different legislators throughout history, both from the House and from the Senate, who had a number of days vacancy that weren't filled. And I would just argue that every time that vacancy is over 30 days, there's something wrong with the process, or there's indication that there might be something wrong with the process, that those people are not being represented. And if I just so that's what I say is that it's not just Representative Knopf's situation. There is a historical pattern here of vacancies taking longer than 30 days to fill. And thus, I took a look at why that might be.
Follow-ups, if I may. It sounds like, though, what you're, in terms of the clear intent, you're really talking about the legislature's intent in passing this statute as opposed to the framers' intent in drafting the Constitution.
Through the chair. I don't think that I said the framers of the Constitution. I said the framers of our form of government. I don't know who created the statute. I don't know when it was created. I was just referring to the process or whoever came up with the statute.
Just for FYI, it was the legislature in 1960.
Thank you.
That's what the statute reflects. Then the other query, I looked at the chart that you provided, if I can follow up further.
Follow up.
The chart you provided has these times. It appears to be the days it was vacant versus the time it took for the governor to make an appointment. And so I'm curious, did you also get information distinguishing whether the governor was complying with a 30-day requirement? And I certainly agree with respect to Representative Knopf's vacancy. The governor did not submit the name within 30 days, but on some of these other vacancies that are longer than 30 days, was that the governor was having problems getting a name, or was that the governor actually met the 30-day requirement, but then for whatever reason, as we've seen sometimes, the legislature takes a little longer to fill the vacancy? And another example was Senator Schauer, when they filled that vacancy due to resignation, he was actually the second round, because I think the first round that was named by the governor, or the governor named somebody and the legislature rejected it, or maybe the governor, I'm not quite sure, but it took longer because of the process. But it sounded like the governor, and I'm curious, how often is the governor slow versus the legislature?
Yes, so I recognized in my opening statement that there are many different reasons that could delay the process. I'm only addressing one particular issue in the statute that to me looks like it's addressed specifically to what happened in Gary Knopf's case with respect to the governor's reasoning for why he didn't make that appointment. And that's particularly what this is addressing. There are undoubtedly other reasons throughout history for all of these others, and I'm not saying that each one of these cases would have been bettered by the change of the statute. That's not what I'm claiming. There are undoubtedly other reasons through the numerous cases there as to why those were delayed.
So, at least in terms of the chart, you don't have any data on the data to show how many times, other than Representative Knopf's case, when the governor didn't meet the 30-day requirement.
No, through the chair. Just one second.
If I may, this. Yes, for the record and through the chair, this is Richard Best, staffer, Representative Carpenter. This chart indicates the days of 30 days or longer on here alone, and there is some highlights in there where it indicates when the governor had appointed somebody and when they had either accepted or not accepted as well.
Yeah, and just to chime in, I'm looking at the chart, and it seems like it would be possible to parse out, based on appointment and confirmation dates, how many instances the governor was the foot dragger versus other parties in the process. Further questions, Representative Clayman?
That was my question, because I do think that this is, the Knopf situation clearly presents a position, place in which the governor took a position of interpreting the statute that Representative Carpenter doesn't agree with. But if this is really the first time when it hasn't been an issue of statutory interpretation, but just somebody didn't, either they didn't submit in time or they did, and then the legislative side took slower, I think that adds a little bit more detail to the analysis from legislative.
Thank you. Yeah, and I guess we can tease it out, but if it's possible to just high grade, I guess, the instances of sort of Gary Knopf situations, it might be helpful just to get a sense of the scope of the precedent. Representative Tard, did you have a question? I wasn't sure if you were in the queue or not.
Thank you. I did. Because I was just trying to sort of think of this specific example and the dynamics around it that are likely not to repeat themselves anytime too soon, probably because it was kind of like the once in a lifetime pandemic, and just sort of how that influenced it. And so I was just looking back that there were the three names submitted, and then it's still sort of unclear to me how the governor thought there wasn't a need to fill this vacancy with the existing language. But because of like how long it was going to be, you know, the several months until the new person would be sworn in. And so, but I'm just wondering, I guess, were there any sort of like specifics about the COVID-19 pandemic that influenced this, I guess, that won't kind of be repeated again or make this one particular example kind of like not the best representative example of these situations because it was so unusual and unique? And so I'm just sorry, I don't remember all of the details, but I do see that names were forwarded. And so the governor just chose not to make the appointment in this circumstance.
Through the chair to Representative Tarr. I don't think that it was COVID related, although you could say that all of our decisions that we made in 2020 were impacted by COVID in some form or fashion. I imagine the governor had late nights and long hours. That's not to say that was impacted his decision. I think more to the point of what your opening statement or your opening question was it's unclear why, and that's exactly what I'm trying to address. Mm-hmm. We aren't really materially changing the legislation more than we are just clarifying that the 30-day requirement for the governor to make an appointment is something that needs to be done, and it is clearing up those exceptions for why he wouldn't have to do it. And it doesn't mean that because there isn't a legislature scheduled to meet that you can't make an appointment. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it would just specify that 30 days prior to the session, you wouldn't have to schedule it or make an appointment within those 30 days because the question is going to resolve itself.
Mm-hmm. Follow up.
And then I was just trying to figure out, you know, it says the governor may not fill the vacancy if, and we always talk about the may versus shall. So then I was thinking, was that the sort of word, the specific word that maybe gave the governor, you know, the feeling that it was okay to not do that appointment? And did you consider, or should it be a shall there so it would be more prescriptive of those only being the circumstances under which it wouldn't happen? I just wondered if you, like, consider that and if there'd be a reason to do that or not do that.
Yeah, so through the chair to Representative Tarr, that was the first question that I asked Ledge Legal, was the may versus shall, and the language may is specifically prohibitive. It is he cannot do
okay.
what he's going to, or what was listed there under these exceptions.
Okay.
And I apologize to the committee. Megan Wallace has been online as well, so if anyone has questions for Legislative Legal, she is available for questions. Further follow-up, Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe Megan Wallace could answer this then. So in this circumstance, and in the earlier question, why didn't someone, you know, take legal action over this? I guess it's just this very unusual circumstance where, you know, legally an appointment could have been made and just was not. But because no action was taken, it just, it's, you know, that that's that. And then the new person was sworn in, I guess. Is that sort of just the set of events? And once it's happened, it's happened.
For the record, Megan Wallace, Legal Services Director, through the chair, Representative Tarr. It's my understanding that AS 1540-320 has been interpreted for, has a longstanding interpretation that the exception in the existing statute provides that the governor may not fill the vacancy if the term of the predecessor will not be filled, will be filled before the legislature again meets, convenes, or reconvenes. And so the reason, it's my understanding, as the sponsor alluded to, that it was the governor's similar interpretation that the governor was prohibited by statute from filling that vacancy because his term would expire before the legislature again met, convened, or reconvened. And if there would have been, for example, maybe a special session called or something popped up where the legislature needed to come back into session, that position then would have been eligible for that for appointment, and the governor could have made the appointment at the time in preparation for the legislature convening or reconvening again. The statute as written is not consistent with the sponsor's intent, meaning that the sponsor's changes to the statute more clearly articulate the intended or the sponsor's intention that the governor be required to make that appointment within 30 days, and the only exception being that the vacancy would occur or that the term would expire within 30 days of the next session. And so it's only my anecdotal understanding that some of the policy reasons surrounding the current interpretation of our existing statute is that it was intended to potentially prevent the governor from appointing an incumbent before an election were to occur, or that if the legislature were not to convene again before the term expired, that the person filled by the governor, for example, wouldn't be able to sit on an interim committee or otherwise participate, because that would require action by the body to appoint a member to a committee or something along those lines. So that's my understanding of our current statute.
And last comment, and I'll just study this more on my own time, but it was just of interest to me too, because the Constitution, the provision in the Constitution reads, a vacancy in the legislature shall be filled for the unexpired term as provided by law. If no provision is made, the governor shall fill the vacancy by appointment. So it doesn't seem like there should be these periods of lack of representation. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. And before we go to Representative Vance next in the queue, I have a couple of questions I want to squeeze in. Representative Carpenter, do you have any conversations with the governor's office about why they did what they did, or what their interpretation of the present statute was in the weeks and months subsequent to Representative Knopf's passing?
No, I did not.
Have you thought about reaching out to the governor's office to get their interpretation or perspective?
No, I have not. May I elaborate?
Yeah, please do.
So like Representative Tarr said, the Constitution lays out a requirement for appointments to be filled. The statute lays out an appointment to be filled. I didn't feel it necessary to go to the governor and ask him why he didn't make the appointments when his public statements or justifications gave me everything that I needed to know. He pointed to the statute, and the statute says he doesn't have the authority to do so. And so I said, I'm the policymaker, so I just need to change the policy so that he has the authority to make the appointments. And I didn't feel it necessary to bother him with additional conversation in that regard.
Thank you. Actually, I think Ms. Wall spoke to my second question. So, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question is for Megan Wallace, and currently, looking back on 2020, the legislature was having conversations about convening, and unofficial polling was taking place among members of whether or not we should, in fact, convene to meet. And I'm just wondering, from a legal perspective, the conundrum that we have of with a vacancy that occurred, there's no member to poll, but the governor, by the way the statute is currently interpreted, would need to appoint someone until the legislature was convening. So how would that interpretation be made of there's no member to poll, but the governor, because we can compel ourselves to come into session, but the governor doesn't have to make an appointment until we're actually in session. So does this bill 124 relieve that ambiguity, or am I just thinking that the current statute has ambiguity in that?
And I might have missed it. Is that a question for Ms. Wallace?
Yes.
Ms. Wallace.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Vance. Given the long-standing interpretation of the existing statute, if there is a desire to ensure that the governor makes an appointment within 30 days, regardless of when the legislature is going to come back into session, then the bill before you clarifies that issue. Because the way the statute has been historically interpreted is that the governor is prevented from making that appointment if the legislature won't meet again. In terms of how it relates to something like polling members for a special session, there would just be a vacancy in that that district or in that Senate district, and that member wouldn't be polled, and it would just be up to two-thirds of the remaining members of the legislature to determine whether or not to call themselves back into special session. And that scenario hypothetically could still exist even if the vacancy is unquestionably eligible for reappointment, in terms of if timing, if the poll happened within the 30 days, before the deadline passed or something like that. So there's always a potential that it may not line up perfectly, but I don't think that is necessarily specifically related to this statute.
Follow up.
So, as the statute currently stands, if we had a scenario where there's a vacancy and the legislature called itself into session within a week time, that said, hey, we're going to meet, we need everybody to be here in 1 week's time, which, if I remember correctly, we have the authority to do that. What would the governor still have the 30-day, would he still have time to the 30-day window, or would he have to fulfill that vacancy within the time that the governor, that the legislature convened a special session?
through the chair, Representative Vance, that issue is not specifically provided for in the current statute, but based on some past precedent, I can only assume, and I can't obviously guarantee that this is the procedure that the governor would take, but if my recollection serves, if we're just using, you know, our most recent examples of vacancies, there was names submitted to the governor, so the governor might in that instance have had names to pick from and could have moved maybe potentially quickly to ensure that someone had been appointed before the special session. But that would leave another open question in terms of the timing, and because this statute's never been litigated, it's difficult to predict if there was a dispute in terms of timing before a special session, what the result of that dispute might come out to be.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Before we go around for a second round, I think I was refreshed on what my additional question is. It's for the sponsor when ready. And I realize this is addressing just a specific part of statute, but I've been around enough and was following the legislature when there was just tremendous ambiguity about appointment processes. This is addressing some ambiguity in the statutes, but especially the second part of legislative confirmation. And it's always struck me that instead of existing in this sort of gray area about how confirmation works and where that authority rests and whether it's advisory or whether the governor has to work from the names given by the, I think it's the district party and members of the same party, all of that, and I could look at those statutes. I'm wondering if you've given any thought to that and I'll just leave it there. Have you given any thought to looking at those statutes as well?
It's interesting as we, to the chair, as I started doing some research on this, I identified that a previous representative who sat in my seat also was asking questions about this and brought a bill forward that didn't make it through the legislature, and he was addressing many more things than just this. And so as I was thinking through this, I said, you know, there probably are some other things that we might want to talk about, but for the sake of the problem that was facing me at the time and just knowing how difficult it is to get bills through, I just simplified it to one issue, and we'll deal with one issue at a time. And that was my thinking on it.
And can I ask, who was that representative?
It was Representative Hodgins.
Hodgins. 80s? 90s?
I think 20th
legislature.
20th legislature.
20th legislature. Okay. Sounds like some crack research going back into the annals. I'm going to now do a second pass. Representative Vance got you, but I just want to go to Representative Eastman, who's been in the queue for some time.
Thank you. And Ms. Wallace, question for you through the chair. Just to clarify, so Article 2, Section 9 of the Constitution, special sessions may be called by the governor or by vote of two-thirds of the legislators. And could you just, at the point of making you repeat yourself, could you just clarify when it says of the legislators, is that referring to of the sitting legislators? As the case that Representative Vance was talking about, there might be fewer than 60 legislators at a particular time.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, yes, it's likely two-thirds of the all 60 legislators, and not just two-thirds of those whose seats are filled. Because we've had scenarios, for example, where there have been vacancies and questions about, you know, how many votes does it take to pass a bill or something like that. And the advice always remains the same, that even if there is an open seat, that we still calculate it based on total membership.
Thank you. Follow up. And I guess just to respond to the concern raised by Representative Vance, it would seem that would militate towards what Representative Tarr was saying a moment ago, that the Constitution seems to be anticipating that as often as possible we'll have a full complement of legislators, and that there's not going to be any excessive delays. On that topic, a question for the sponsor. So as I look at, you know, under the current language of the bill, how closely that matches, I think, your intent of not having these excessively long delays, it would seem to me that the second exception, the one dealing with the Senate, could yield towards a very long delay. You know, I'm looking at if we had a 90-day session April 19th or thereabouts up until...
90-day session?
You know, optimistically, okay. It has happened. You know, from that, just until the election is over 200 days. And it's not clear to me that just because the elections happened, that changes anything. I think maybe it extends past the election to the next legislature, which could be closer to 250 or more. And I'm just wondering, is there a way that we can tighten that down so we don't have this potential for a 250-day vacancy just because it's someone in the Senate?
So through the chair to Representative Eastman, I suppose that there could be a way to tighten that down. It is not something that I looked at with this piece of legislation, mm-hmm. and I wasn't even attempting to address that. Okay. Second, as a member of the House, I kind of strayed away from dealing with something that would affect the Senate.
Why bother?
Thank you.
Follow up. Thank you. And on that note, since that Senate potential vacancy could be quite lengthy, and we've had legislators who've resigned or passed on relatively close to each other, it looks to me, and I don't think this is your intent, but it looks to me like if we're in that potentially 250-day window in the Senate and we have a vacancy in the House, that the governor would not be able to fill the vacancy in the House either, because you have the or language and the Senate vacancy exists, which would limit the governor being able to appoint anyone, including a House representative.
If I can take just a second to make sure I understand what Representative Eastman is saying here. So, through the chair to Representative Eastman, I'm not exactly sure how to answer that, and I think I would probably refer to Ledge Legal for an answer on that. But my first take would be that the point number one is a point addressing to House vacancies, that we don't have special elections for House vacancies, and that the second one is specifically for dealing with Senate vacancies. But I would defer to somebody who with a law degree with some authority.
We can make that happen. It would seem to me the question is, what is the power of the semicolon in this situation? Which seems like an appropriate question for Max Gruenberg. But we'll refer to Megan Wallace. Ms. Wallace, if you're with us, can you speak to Representative Eastman's question?
Sure, through the chair. Can you repeat? I was listening along, but can Representative Eastman, would you mind just repeating your question one more time to make sure I answer it specifically?
Yeah, gladly. So the operative language on line 10 is the governor may not fill the vacancy, and we're not distinguishing there whether the vacancy is a House or a Senate vacancy. And then we add qualifying language about when he cannot fill the vacancy, and we have option one or option two. And it would seem to me that if there is a Senate vacancy, which is caught up under option two, and we have, you know, in that same window of time, a House vacancy, that even though maybe the intent right now is that the House vacancy wouldn't get caught up, the or language could potentially mean that the House vacancy is caught up with the Senate vacancy. I just wanted to ask you first your opinion on that.
Yes, for the record again, Megan Wallace, Legal Services Director. Thank you for that clarification. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, so we're getting into the good stuff, so to speak, right? So thank you for that question and allowing me to talk about semicolons and things like that. But I interpret or read these two paragraph 1 and paragraph 2 as not dependent on one another, and if you had both a House and a Senate vacancy that occurred at the same time, that it would just depend on which paragraph was operable that would control the scenario, because it certainly seems possible that you could have, for example, a Senate vacancy that fit the parameters of paragraph one, and other vacancies that, you know, fit the parameters of paragraph two. So the or there would allow for whichever provision to control that is applicable to the circumstances of the vacancy.
Follow up. Maybe to ask the question slightly differently. Is there any clarifying language that we could introduce to make clear our intent that the fact that a vacancy in the Senate is waiting for a special election does not trigger the governor not being able to fill a vacancy in the House?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I don't want to, you know, speak off the top of my head, but to the extent that there was some desire, I would be happy to work with someone's office on either the amendment on an amendment or the sponsor's office if that's the sponsor's intent, to see if it's necessary or what language we could come up with.
Thank you. Follow up?
On the same subject?
Different topic,
Representative Eastman.
Thank you very much, and appreciate the conversation on that. I'm remembering not too long ago now, 2 years ago, we were in a situation where there was a vacancy in the House, and we were asked, the Republican legislators were asked, since it was a Republican vacancy, to confirm the appointee twice. And we were asked to confirm them once during the session of the previous legislator that had resigned. In this case, it was Representative Nancy Dahlstrom who had resigned. And we were asked to confirm Representative Jackson as the appointee to fill her seat. And then, because of the ambiguity in the statute here, we did have conversation with the governor's office, and there was an interpretation at the time that, you know, maybe the governor wasn't actually allowed to appoint Representative Jackson to complete what was at that time Representative Sadler's term of office. You can't think these things up. He, of course, had kind of opted out by virtue of joining the administration, which created another set of problems. But in any event, we were asked to take a vote on Representative Jackson to fill that session, and then said, all right, well, maybe we're not allowed to do that because of the way the statute's written. And then later on, after the new session had started, we were asked to again take a vote to confirm her to that position. And hopefully we can avoid that happening again. But I was just curious if you had any intent on whether or not a vacancy, when we get to that confirmation process, should be filled by the same legislators who are elected at the same time that the representative who's no longer there is there, or is there a benefit to waiting and then having them confirmed by that next class of legislators? Because we kind of had a situation where we were trying to do both.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, and I believe the timing of which was delayed significantly going into actually forming a organized government. So I guess the way that I would answer that is, under the current language, and I will use the word that I've chosen is ambiguity, it isn't clear. And that's how maybe we got the conflict that we had at that time. And I would just say that the language that I have presented here would have made it very clear that if the vacancy is within the 30 days prior to the start of that next legislature, that the governor wouldn't make an appointment, and that whoever was elected in November come the start of the next legislative cycle would fill that seat, and there wouldn't be an appointment in those 30 days. Now, if there's a vacancy that occurred longer than 30 days ago, then he could make that appointment. So, I guess what I'm trying to articulate here is, if there's ambiguity that has gotten us to where we're at now or in the past couple election cycles, I would hope that this language would clarify that ambiguity and make it very clear. That's how I would answer that question.
Thank you very much. Follow?
Final follow-up, and then go to Representative Vance.
Now, in the case of Representative Knopp, I believe that the vacancy occurred in either July or August, but in any case, before the primary election. Is it your intent, or do you have any opinions one way or the other on limiting a governor's ability to appoint someone in, you know, say, some period of time right before an election takes place? Or, you know, if you have an opinion either way, I'd be very happy to hear that. And then also, if a governor was allowed to make that appointment, is it valuable to allow the governor to have a discretion to choose not to, I guess, voluntarily? If, you know, we're kind of in the may and may not, and we're not really allowing a lot of discretion, but is there value in giving a governor discretion in those kind of scenarios?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I guess I would let the Constitution be my guide on this, and I'm confident that representation of the people in their form of government is of the highest order. And so putting language into the law that gives discretion to one branch over the other, or the executive for in this this instance, to not appoint, doesn't make sense to me. That every district has an expectation that they will be represented in the legislature, and to the extent that the governor would have the discretion to not to prevent that from happening in the political arena that we are in, doesn't make sense to me from a constitutional point of view, from a structural point of view, from a fairness point of view. We all want to have representation in our form of government, and there's no way to take the politics out of it. It's a, by design or by default, a political process, and thus I think, even though I can see where there would be conflict just approaching an election and the timing is just right that it's going to inflame things, the reality is somebody needs to be the representative for people to look to for questions and whatnot. So I guess that's the best way that I would answer it is, and it's a political, or it's a personal opinion at this point, right? We're all entitled to those, and that's the way that I look at it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
If only Mr. Fisher were still online, we could solicit his input on this question. Representative Vance, and just for the note, in terms of time budgeting, allow you a line of questioning and then I think set the bill aside in order to consider the last two pieces of legislation today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have another question for Megan Wallace, and this was based, the thought came after you asked questions. You know, in this bill, in the statute, it refers to, you know, appointing a qualified person, and we know that, you know, the appointment has to come through the political party. You know, three people from that political party will then forward names to the governor. But what happens if the member who resigned is unaffiliated?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I would have to put my finger on the specific statute, but the current statutes provide for that scenario.
And maybe we can set that aside, because I, too, have interest in this scenario. I think it's outside the bounds somewhat of the bill as presently written, but I think at a future hearing, I at least am interested in sort of interrogating some of that statutory language. So maybe we can rein check on those questions and also give Ms. Wallace a little bit of time to prepare accordingly.
Yes.
But if you have other questions, Representative Vance, on maybe a different subject, please proceed.
Not at this time.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Representative Carpenter, for bringing the bill forward. As noted, I think we'll take this up potentially next week, we'll be in touch with the committee and the sponsor on timing. But thank you for making the time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and fellow committee members for hearing the bill.
Thank you. I'm going to take a brief at ease as Representative McCarty might situate himself, and members can maybe stretch their legs a little bit because we still have two more not lightweight pieces of legislation before us. So we're at ease. Going back on the record at 4:45, nice healthy break. We're refreshed. We have warm drinks at our side, and Representative McCarty is with us with HB 142. This is the second hearing, and we kind of rolled with the punches last time with a telecom outage, so only Rep. McCarty and staff are with us. But today we have Bobby Scherer with the PFD Division and Department of Revenue available for questions. I imagine there will, in fact, be many questions. We also have public testimony, and we have Tiffany Lund, who's online, who's also staff to Rep. McCarty. So there's public testimony notice. Before we go there, Rep. McCarty, any opening comments you'd like to make before we commence?
Thank you, Chair. Representative Ken McCarty from Eagle River, Chugiak, J-Bear, District 13. And I'm glad that we're here with technology working and we could get some of the questions answered. And we have people that are wanting to testify, and some are going to pick up their kids, so we'll try to get them back on. But yeah, we're here to move forward.
Wonderful. And I'll open and close public testimony, but if there are certain individuals who you know who were on or made a good faith attempt to sort of match the window of the committee, let me know and we can try to accommodate them. So with that, I'm going to open public testimony. I suppose testimony in the room is a little bit of a formality given current circumstances, but I will look online. And we'll start with Bert. How telling. How did I do?
You did much better this time.
Great. Well, you're first up. Please go ahead and present your testimony. I'm going to do two or fewer minutes, given it's a little bit more in the queue.
From what I've heard of this particular bill, I'm not too much against what is being done. It looks like just a pretty much a fundamental change to make it easier for those that are working out of state to be able to file for their permanent fund dividend, and more better clarification of the pre-FD rules that are based upon eligibility. As long as that is all this is, I am for the bill currently. I would like to take the rest of my time and address HB 73 that for some reason I was hung up on when it came time to get testimony and wasn't able to provide it. On HB 73, I'm against the governor's bill for that. That's the companion bill to the other HJR bill that is out there. And the combination of the both is just as I stated earlier, it is given the combination of the money to the legislators to up to your sole discretion on whether or not us Alaskans will ever get to see a PFD in the future. So that makes me 100% against it. And I feel unfortunate that the last word for the legislator that decided to speak up and say that I don't represent him, I am thankful for that after watching the illegal binding caucus rule that had been put into place this year again in the House majority coalition there. It is unfortunate that you don't support the majority of Alaskans, but clearly support the minority special interests by selling out our voices and votes to all of them. Thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Hautelian. I think you managed to speak on three disparate subjects in less than 2 minutes. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you for taking the time to testify. And on behalf of the legislature, apologies about the hang-up mishap on HB 73, but glad you were able to get in your 2 cents. We'll move next in the queue to Nolan Heath in Eagle River. If you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on record, and present your testimony in two or fewer minutes. Can you hear us? Oh, there we go. You might be muted, but we just heard a little gargle of phone noise.
Can you hear me now?
There we go.
Okay, this is Nolan Heath from Eagle River. I'm a former veteran of the Vietnam War. I'm the military who may or in service of war or something like that should be entitled to apply for and receive a dividend. Those who are not, or who maybe are reassigned to another base outside of Alaska, even though they may maintain their Alaska residency, I don't feel should be eligible for a dividend because of the 90-day rule being outside of the state, similar to what applies to many religious organizations who may send missionaries around the world to serve, and because they're out for 90 days or more, are not deemed eligible. However, once those people come back in the state and have been here and meet those requirements, not being gone for more than 90 days, they would again be eligible for a dividend. And I that's the way it should be. I don't think they should be entitled to it otherwise. And that's my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Heath, for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you for taking the time to testify. And I see a couple of other individuals who were on but are no longer, Latrice Williams of Eagle River and also Charles McKee of Anchorage. And so if either of them would like to testify at a future date, certainly want to make that accommodation. And so if they happen to hear this, feel free to reach out to my office or the sponsor's office and we can accommodate that at a future date. So that rounds out everyone online for testimony for HB 142, so I'm going to close public testimony. It takes the bill back before the committee. And committee questions. Are there questions for the sponsor or the PFD division? Well, I'll kick things off. Okay, so from the Department of Revenue, I think this was when the bill was in Judiciary Committee, there was a written response to committee questions, and one of those questions, I actually don't have the letter in front of me. Yeah, it was dated April 28, addressed to Representative Klayman, Judiciary Chair, and one of the questions was, where in Alaska Station Regulations is there language allowing an Alaskan or snowbird to be absent for up to 180 days? And the answer was AS 4323-008, and then there was a regulatory citation. And I had previously looked at this, and I may not understand the structure between statute and regulation. I'm hoping, Michelle, you can help enlighten us. But it kind of blew my mind that the 180-day threshold was not in law but was in regulation. It's in 15 AAC 23.163, and it's subsection B of that citation, which I have printed in front of me, and we can copy and distribute if that's helpful to other members of the committee. But would you be able to if you know, speak to how that came to pass, and also speak to, you know, if in theory it would be possible for the Department of Revenue through the regulatory process to either increase or decrease that threshold to, say, 120 days or 250 days.
For the record, my name is Bobby Scher, and I'm with the appeals manager with the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. To the chair, in answer to your question, the language was in law from 1999 through 2003 under Alaska Statute 4323.00813A, which specifically listed the 180 days. That did change with the 2004 statutes and regulations publication read what it is presently. As to your question about whether we could address this through regulatory changes and or change the number of allowable days, I would have to defer to those higher up than me, and we would have to get back to you with that answer.
Thank you. And so you mentioned this was in law until 2003 or 2004. Was there a piece of legislation that took it out of law?
I don't have that precise answer. I would have to get back to you on that.
If you're able to find that information, I know the committee, I know I would appreciate it, and we can also muck around in the legislative record as well. But I this seems to me like a very relevant piece of policy, and that it's in regulation is striking to me. Representative McCarty.
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, that it is in statute. So the 180-day guideline that if you go beyond 180 days, that's in statute. The book is over to my right here. The question of whether it can be changed or not, that's something we could decide on. I think that if we increase that, not going to pick on them, but we'll just use the example of, you know, the snowbirds, that if we make it 250 days, then they could stay, you know, in another state for that period of time, which we would miss out on having them here and sharing with our economy in that process. So. But it is in statute.
Thank you. Yeah, and just to put my cards on the table, I think my predilection would be potentially tighten the number of allowable days so that, you know, at least there's a strong majority of the year that someone be in Alaska in order to qualify, but that's just my perspective. Other questions from the committee?
Brief at ease.
going back on the record, and thank you, Representative Tarr, for bringing my attention to some statutes. Other questions from the committee? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This question is for Ledge Legal. I'm not sure if they're on the line. I know you're trying to get them. But I'm looking at the memo from Department of Revenue.
Representative Vance, I can just say they're not on the line yet, so should we hold off on the question?
Well, we can. I can get there.
Sure.
So we were sent a memo from the Department of Revenue to Judiciary Committee with some of the questions, and it goes along with some of the highlights of the notes that I've had on the CS that we accepted in this committee regarding page 3, line 26, section 3, the repeal language about the allowable absences. And on page 1 of the Judiciary memo from Department of Revenue, it says the question was regarding the Peace Corps, but on the answer it says if this bill passes with language repealing the sections outlined in, or the statutes outlined in section 3, it says all of which apply to all allowable absences, the division will apply the law consistently and uniformly. Repealing these statutes will increase the number of eligible applicants each year that are absent on allowable absences. So when we have Ledge Legal on the line, I'd like to have them describe the ramifications, because obviously I want to understand any unintended consequences by repealing that language, because I've been trying to look in statute about exactly what it is that's being repealed. But before we have them online, if the maker of the bill could, you know, speak to the intent of what they're trying to do, that would be helpful.
Absolutely. Representative McCarty.
Okay, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Vance, this is Representative McCarty. That the intent of the bill is to have equitable nature in the permanent fund dividend, and not everybody gets to move from the state and keep collecting the permanent fund dividend. We have given that to people in the military that leave, and they have language of intent to return, but we don't know, and they don't know, whether they're going to fulfill that intent. There's other people in the state that may have intent to return to, but they've not given that privilege. And so to keep the permanent fund dividend, I think the chair brought up an example of a pie, or used fractions, but having a pie that the people that reside in the state are the ones getting the pieces of the pie, not people that leave the state and they get to keep on collecting the pie. So that's the intent of it. If there's language in there that jeopardizes the first 16 exemptions, you know, I would like to hear from the department or the division what that language is that does something like that, or from legal. But yeah.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, and before you go, I just want to note that Emily Nauman from Legislative Legal is now online.
Thank you. I'd love to hear from legal, and then perhaps we can hear from the department. That way we can make sure that there's consistent interpretation about the repeal language and the ramifications with all of the other exemptions.
Ms. Nauman, did you catch Representative Vance's initial question?
Chair Kreis-Hunkin, no, I did not. I'm just joining this committee. I have no idea what's happened so far.
Ah, great. Welcome. Representative Vance, would you mind repeating the question?
Yes, I will. And thank you so much for being on at short notice. I'm looking at the committee substitute for HB 142, page 3, line 26. It's repealing statutes, and it's regarding the 72-hour rule. And I'm just wondering what the legal interpretation would be on the other allowable absences, if it would. I'm wondering what the full impact would be, so that we can understand what that would be, because we received a memo from the Department of Revenue that said repealing these statutes will increase the number of eligible applicants each year that are absent on allowable absences. So can you describe the impact of that repeal language?
Sure. For the record, this is Emily Nowen, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair. Currently, if a person is allowed to be absent for the list of reasons under 4323-008, but as the law exists now, 4323-005 requires that even if they're absent as under a permissible allowable absence, which allows them to be absent, say, for the entire year, that no matter what, they are required to be in the state physically present for 72 consecutive hours during the prior 2 years before the current dividend year. This bill repeals that requirement. So if a person is out for with an allowable absence, they're no longer required to be in the state as a prerequisite for getting a dividend for at least 72 hours in the prior 2 years. And I hope my interpretation is consistent with the department.
That seems consistent with my understanding.
All right. Thank you for
follow
that,
up? I think. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. And this is going to be for the division. We had spoken earlier about that same issue, so we're making some people less eligible and other people's more eligible. And I'm trying to get some metrics on that. How many people are becoming more eligible, and how many people are we estimating are becoming less eligible, and what's the net?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, Bobby Scher again for PSD Division. We do have a response for the committee in writing. You should have it for your next meeting. I apologize you hadn't received it sooner. Regarding how many people might be more eligible because the repeal of Alaska Statute 4323-00584 does affect all allowable absences, we did some research and found that we had an average of 14,500 individuals per year over a two-year period who had the 72-hour issue on their application. And this would mean that those 14,500 individuals would no longer have to prove that their absence they were claiming, they would no longer have to prove they had returned to Alaska for 72 consecutive hours to help show their intent to remain a resident.
Follow up?
Follow up.
And if there's 14,000 on that side of the equation, how many are on the other side of the equation that now are no longer eligible?
How many of the individuals who of the 14,500 were denied? Is that the question?
No, and your first answer really didn't get to my question either. What I'm looking for is an estimate from the department on how many dividends you expect to be eligible and processed after this bill goes into law versus historic expectations.
At this point in time, maybe this would address your question. Of the 14,500 individuals, 2,000 were denied for non-response or not providing the proof. So those 2,000 would then become eligible. The remaining of the 14,500 just wouldn't have to provide that proof again. They're all part of that same pie, that eligibility pie. But right now, they are complying and providing the proof. The 2,000 people who were denied because they did not provide the proof of the 72 consecutive hours, they would then have become eligible and not have to prove it.
Follow up. And on the military side of the equation, or whatever side of the equation is becoming more restrictive, can you give us an estimate on how many fewer candidates would be considered eligible based on those more tightened restrictions?
Through the chair, Representative, I'm sorry we were not able to break this out by absence type. This was we were able to count it by the issue built around this particular statute, which required 72 consecutive hours for all absence, all allowable absence types under Alaska Statute 4323008A.
Thank you. Question for the sponsor?
And I'm just going to jump in to clarify my understanding on Ms. Scherer's response. So there's 14,500 individuals who currently are able to qualify as eligible under the current statutes who, given passage of this bill, would no longer be eligible. But there's also, I think you said, 2,000 people who are presently not eligible, and the 72-hour requirement kind of kicks them out of the eligibility pool. So is my math right that that leaves a net reduction in eligible individuals of 12,000 or 12,500?
Could you repeat, was that directed to me? This is Bobby again.
Yeah, sorry for the ambiguity. That was directed to you. So the question is, with passage of this bill, there's 14,500 folks who are presently claiming the PFD under the current active duty eligibility exemption. And so presumably most or all, probably most of those people will be no longer in the eligibility pool, but by deleting the 72-hour requirement, there's, I think you said, 2,000 or so people who claim eligibility because of that, or who are denied eligibility because of that 72-hour requirement. So presumably some or most or all of those people now enter the eligibility pool. So is the analysis accurate that 14,500 minus 2,000, and I realize that these are not going to be absolute numbers, but roughly speaking, that the net reduction in eligibility will be 12,000, 12,500 individuals, if this very rough math is accurate?
Thank you for clarifying through the chair, Representative. The number of, I believe what I should share with you is the number of active duty military individuals and their families who would no longer be eligible for the dividend came out to an average of 10,000 per year.
Got it. And forgive me for missing it. What was the 14,000 individual figure that was mentioned?
The 14,500 were the number of individuals applying for a dividend claiming an allowable absence under all allowable absence types who were identified as needing to provide proof of 72 consecutive hours back in Alaska.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And just for my, you know, understanding, and also for the record, so what under the bill is going to be the longest period of time someone could be outside of Alaska? You know, going to school, going to college, going to university, going to, you know, some type of training program that's currently eligible. What is that longest period of time that the bill would permit?
Through the chair, Representative, there would not be a change to the other allowable absence types. I would refer to Alaska Statute 4323008D, which requires that an individual absent for five consecutive years for more than 180 days in those five consecutive qualifying years, they then would have to prove that they've returned to the state for at least 30 cumulative days in order to maintain their residency in Alaska through the PFD program. So it would not... There's no end date in our statute or regulation with regard to this type of absence ongoing as long as they meet those requirements.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
And then same question for those who are out of state, out of Alaska for military reasons. What's that longest period of time that someone can be out of state in the armed forces?
Through the chair, the type of absence in this bill would require a deployment or a temporary duty assignment, and there's no length of time specifically limiting it. I believe a deployment or temporary duty assignment is temporary in nature, but would still fall under the same rules as the rest of the allowable absences with 008D for the five-year rule.
Thank you. And so question for the sponsor then.
Follow up.
And that's going to be, so deployments or TDYs, how long are we talking in your, what's your intent of, as far as those military deployments or TDY? What are you expecting that longest time to be?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that's the discretion of the military. So if someone's on a several-year deployment, but they're based out of Alaska, we're not going to, put them at fault for that. They're serving, and whatever the TDY type of situation. So currently, we have arrangements for merchant marine in the statute. We recognize them that they could be out for longer than 180 days, but there is no maximum for them, and we don't want to put a maximum for our military members that are serving.
Thank you. Another question?
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair. So now I know we're a little bit special sometimes in Wasilla, but I guess I should ask to get your intent. So we do have fortune to have an Alaska astronaut in Wasilla. How would you see PFD eligibility being for someone who's away in space? I know, some folks have been in space for longer than a year.
This reminds me of when we had the ballot fax bill and we were contemplating a submariner who was out of all worldly communication and attempting to vote.
Indeed.
Representative McCarty.
Yes, thank you.
Well, through the chair, Representative Eastman, that's an interesting question. I think the first thing I wonder is, does NASA, is that considered in the categories of the military in some way, just like the Coast Guard is not the military, but it's under the Homeland Security, but it's, in our minds, military, so that brings up the question of some space program that's a professional business, like we just had, I believe, astronauts return back to Earth from the space station, but they were with, what's the name of the company?
SpaceX,
yep. Sorry. You know, so they were an independent company. I guess they wouldn't qualify if it's an independent company, but if it's a military-related type thing, if NASA fits into that category there, then there may be your answer.
It's the Intergalactic Merchant Marine.
That's correct.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, Chair Price Tompkins, and thank you, Representative McCarty, for this bill and the discussion that it's bringing up. One question I had is if you had been able to talk to any liaison in military and Veterans Affairs about the 10,000 people that possibly would not be eligible anymore and any reasons that they had of concern about this happening.
I have not talked to the VA. I have talked to talked to the people, the VFW and the American Legion, and that these people living in Alaska and resounding no, they shouldn't get the money. They've left the state.
Follow up. I think of a situation where there was a denial about a military person getting a PFD last year that I had heard about where there seemed to be circumstances that should have been allowed, and I won't go into that, but thank you for reaching out there. And I did want to say that members of this committee might know that I've been concerned that there are a couple of groups who are not currently allowed to receive a PFD, and that is our commissioned officer corps. We've got, they're part of the Uniformed Services of the United States, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA Commissioned Officer Corps, and the United States Public Health Service Commissioned Corps. And to me, I've been concerned that they haven't been allowed. And I know your bill is, you know, trying to tighten it up and make sure that everyone under this bill is eligible to receive a permit fund dividend. And I would like to I know I'm going to try to propose an amendment to this bill and talk to the members about what I think is an oversight that wasn't meant to happen. But I certainly would like to talk to you more about that after committee. And I always feel it's really important that the sponsor of the bill understands and is comfortable in amendments. And so anyway, I just wanted to bring that up on the record right now.
Thank you, Representative Story. Representative McCarty.
Through the chair, Representative Story, I share that. I actually have people that have worked for me that are in the Corps, retired from that, and have served in Alaska. And so I think that, and I'm open to hearing more of your thoughts as we honor these individuals. I see that the guidelines for being recognized is in 005. And so if the person, whoever it is recognized and fulfilling the guidelines to be a candidate for the permanent fund dividend in the first place under 005, then that's great. And the same thing exists for the military currently, that as they fulfill the guidelines of they've moved here, they've been stationed here, and now they've been here a year, then they qualify. They don't qualify right away. They have to follow guidelines of 005. And that pertains to all.
Yes, thank you. Yes, these are residents of the state of Alaska who serve in these different commissions. And I feel they do qualify for being able to get the dividend, even though they are gone on long absences of service to our country. So thank you.
The plot may thicken with the research vessel Fairweather coming to Ketchikan with a full complement of crew, too. So it'll be interesting. Mm-hmm. A quick question I have for Ms. Scherer online, not so much to the text of 142 as presently written, but kind of piqued by Representative Eastman's question. And in the allowable absence list, 4323.008A1, so this is the allowable absence for receiving secondary or post-secondary education on a full-time basis. My question is, would this include graduate school? So if you have someone gets their undergrad degree at UA or out of state, doesn't really matter, and they continue on and get a 7-year doctorate in English literature or whatever, and PhD programs seem to go longer and longer and longer, would such an individual qualify under the current language of that allowable absence?
Through the chair, yes, the answer, someone in graduate school would fall under that category.
And do you happen to have handy how many individuals qualify for this allowable absence? I realize you can't necessarily differentiate between undergraduate or graduate school, but just total that allowable absence, A1.
I don't have it at my fingertips, but it won't take us long to get it, and we can put that in response to you.
Thank you. And if it'd be possible, if it's all the same, and I imagine it might be, just a list of all the claimed allowable absences, all, what is it, 17 of them or whatnot, and just how many people qualify under each respective allowable absence. Would that be possible?
I will have to check with my IT team.
Okay, thank you. And a final follow-up on this section A1. Just in your experience, and I realize you may not be able to answer this, but do you have any sense of what proportion of allowable absences claimed under A1 are
graduate school or something other than undergraduate or vocational or technical education?
To the chair, without having a report in front of me, my impression is all I can give you, and the majority that I see are four-year college students.
Okay, thank you. Representative Coffin.
Thank you. Through the chair, to Ms. Scher, I'm wondering, sometimes when we deal with the specifics of something such as this issue, we talk about seeing it in tabular form of how we might be able to see the different exclusions or references. Is there any kind of tabular version of conformance that you use in managing this that we might see? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative, you're asking for, I think, the same thing in a tabular form, how many of each allowable absence type?
Yes, ma'am, through the chair.
I believe our system can pull this information. It's not something that I look at personally as the appeals manager.
Thank you.
Seeing no questions, back to Representative Eastman.
Thank you very much, and definitely don't want to hog the microphone. I want to echo the comments of Representative Story in talking about the uniformed services and coming up with a decision from the committee on whether or not they should continue to be excluded. And I guess for the sponsor, I would say I think that the tabular information will be very helpful. I hope we can find that either from the department or from your office. What I think it will show is that we are going to be allowing individuals for up to 5 years to be off at school, to be working in congressional offices, to be serving in the Peace Corps and other things. And we're not allowing that same opportunity for our Alaska servicemen who are, being reassigned to other places. And that's a concern to me, that we are, in effect, giving a preference to those types of service and not so much to military service. And so I'm just wondering if there's a way that we can make that more equitable.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that's a good question. And one of the things that the original drafting was to look at some other industries, and that's been brought up by several people. Someone that is, resident of Alaska, and they join the military, and they do all the things, and then they are sent out. Are they going to lose their PFD, where a student goes off to, and I'm thinking of my son who's in med school, the long process of education that takes, and he wouldn't lose his PFD. Is that fair? And my response is no. And so if there's a friendly amendment to deal with that, that's very well accepted.
Thank you. A follow-up?
Thank you. Last follow-up, and then we have a testifier who's back on the line.
Good.
And then look to move to the final piece of legislation today. Representative Eastman.
And just for the committee, we did hear that, at the end of 5 years, that grad student or someone else can reset the clock by being here for 30 days. And in a lot of occupations and careers, that's probably very doable. Having been in the military for about 10 years myself, there were very few times in that 10 years that the military was willing to let me go for 30 days at a time. So I don't know that would be something that might be available to all these other folks, but might not practically be available to members of the military. And so if we can, work with the committee on that, that would be, I think, an improvement to your bill.
Thank you. Any final comment, Representative McCarty, before we go to our last testifier?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So at this time, I'm going to reopen public testimony, and Latrice Williams, who was previously in the queue, is back online. And
Latrice, if you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on record, and present your testimony in two or fewer minutes.
Hi, I'm Latrice Williams. We're a prior active duty military that was stationed here. We're proud to be vets and Alaskans. The state of Alaska has so much to offer to most military service members feeling lucky to get stationed here. You believe that military members are physically here should be able to receive the dividend, just like other Alaskans. But when they move, they shouldn't keep getting the dividend. Just like most other Alaskans that don't get to keep it. The dividend should only be for those people who are physically resigned here. And I think that's all I have. But I do agree that if we're stationed here, a lot of service members are stationed here for 3 years. 3 years should be able to file for the dividend. But if they're PCSing to other states, I think that the dividend should be taken away.
Thank you, Ms. Williams, for your testimony. I don't see any questions from the committee, so thank you so much for circling back and taking the time to testify. So I'm going to reclose public testimony at this time. And we'll set the bill aside and bring it back for further consideration. Thank you very much, Representative McCurdy, for making the time.
Okay, thank you.
And I'll follow up with the committee members about a possible amendment deadline or how we want to approach this. It occurs to me that there could be a couple of different paths given committee interest, although I'm speaking for myself, I'm very interested in the direction of the bill, and I think this is long overdue for the legislature taking a look at these statutes. So thank you, Representative McCurdy. That takes us to the final piece of legislation on today's agenda, HB 5, and I am determined that this will be the final hearing of this legislation, so we'll look to the will of the committee for a possible motion to discharge. And where we left things previously was the final amendment, Amendment G.6, that was up before the committee. And online for questions is James Stinson with Office of Public Advocacy, and Renee McFarland with the Public Defender Agency, and I believe Department of Law has been in communication with our office, and hopefully they'll be available soon. I know they're aware of the hearing. So my goal is to take up consideration of the amendment and then consider the bill on final passage in committee, so to speak. I think there was an outstanding motion to move Amendment G.6, but maybe just for redundancy's sake can re-entertain the motion just to get it back on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Amendment G.6.
I'll object for discussion.
There's an objection. And Representative Tarr, feel free to sort of pick up more or less where we left off or wherever you think would be most helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we did distribute sort of a summary document, thinking that it had been a little while since we'd seen the amendment, to try and refresh folks' memory. And so hopefully people have that in front of them. And the three things that this amendment does: tightens up the language regarding the rape by fraud. And that was, you know, based on the discussion that had taken place in committee and wanting to be clear about the circumstances under which this provision would be applied. And then we had discussion in the committee, and I would consider it a friendly amendment to add the word actual physical identity because there was, or remove physical and just have actual identity, because there was, again, just discussion around clarity on this point, and that is what we hope to achieve with the amendment. So that's the first part of it. And then because of the way it was situated in the original legislation, sexual assault in the first degree is an unclassified felony, and that put this provision in as an unclassified felony. And so this bumps that down. And so the rape by fraud from unclassified to Class A, and then the basically sexual contact by fraud to the Class B felony. And so those are the three items that are in the amendment, and again, would consider it a friendly amendment based on the discussion from last meeting and Mr. Skidmore's comments and others, that we strike the word physical and put actual identity, I think is what people settled on as being the best selection.
And just to muddy the waters before we go to Representative Eastman, it would be great to hear testimony to this, but I might be the odd one out in terms of the relative benefits of actual vis-a-vis physical, but of course we can see where the committee goes. Representative Eastman.
I just wanted to ask the committee, we kind of got stopped halfway through the conversation, but what would the committee feel about replacing physical with personal? When we talk about identity theft and so forth, Jenna, we're talking personal identity. It would seem to me that there's a potentially a strong parallel in this case as well.
Representative Tarr, please feel free to offer your thoughts, and I know I'll also want to consult some of the attorneys online as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's the best feedback we can get in terms of sort of the wordsmithing, because don't want any unintended consequences, so I appreciate their input on that.
Let's go to Mr. Stinson. Mr. Stinson, can you share your thoughts on the implications of personal identity versus the current language in the bill, which is physical identity?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Craig Tompkins. For the record, this is James Stinson, the Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. This is a tricky one for me, because I can understand how a regular reading, if you were to change this to actual, when I think of actual, it just means sort of existing in fact, typically as contrasted with what was intended, expected, or believed. I mean, that's the Google sort of definition of it. I could see how somebody would consider someone's quote-unquote actual identity to be relatively broad. When we think of what somebody's actual identity is, for example, we think of somebody's, you know, maybe their name, their date of birth. We think of it sort of all-encompassing. I understand what the legislative intent is, but I can understand how that would be confusing, especially with then the following explanation, which is not based on characteristics, traits, or accomplishments, even though we sometimes often think of that in terms of someone's actual identity. In regard to personal, the word personal, I understand the intention behind that as well. Again, looking at the general definition, you could say that that's basically belonging to a particular person rather than anyone else. That seems to make sense. I understand the tension with using physical, but part of me also recognizes that that does seem to be what the legislative intent is to say that this would literally have to be a different body, right, a different physical person. I don't know of any other ways that this is used in current law, though, but in saying physical identity, the way I interpret that is in line with the legislative intent, which is that this is literally a different physical body, regardless of what other, you know, characteristics or traits or things that would belong to a particular person. It really comes down to someone's physical identity. I think that's about as clear as I can get, because I know we're in sort of uncharted territory, and ultimately a lot of this is a policy call, but I do understand why physical was chosen in this case.
Representative Eastman, any follow-up?
Yes, I suppose through the chair, and I guess the question could be for anyone with a legal mind. When we talk about physical identity, and I know we've bantered around the conversation quite a few times, something that's not quite clear to me and maybe others in the committee, when someone is maybe intending to, you know, have sexual contact with someone that they don't know, is that, does that get captured in physical identity? The idea being, I'm sure there are times when an individual is choosing to have physical contact with someone they don't know, whether that's in a state that allows for prostitution or whatever it is, you're trying to have physical contact with someone you don't know. Is it enough to trigger this crime if it's in fact someone that they do know, but they were in fact defrauded into thinking that it was someone they don't know? So the distinction I'm trying to draw is physical identity. Does it have to be a specific person that we can have a name for? Or is it also a violation if it's someone they don't know versus someone they do know? Does that make sense?
Mr. Stinson, want to give that a shot?
So through the chair, I just want to make sure I understand what Representative Eastman is trying to say. A scenario might be helpful. I guess what I'm trying to understand, and I'll kick it back with this example. Would it be like someone meeting online, getting quote unquote catfished, where it's somebody that actually knows them, but they're impersonating a different identity, and then there's somehow a meetup where for some reason they're not able to see the person, and they have potential sex, and then lights come on, and they realize it's actually somebody known to them. Is that sort of what you're getting at?
I'm getting at situations where you don't actually see the person physically, whether it's because it's dark, or whether it's because there's smoke, or whether it's because there's something, some physical barrier in between the parties. Any of those situations, you don't see the person, so you can't physically identify them. And so, in that situation, is physical the right word, and is it capturing, how broad is it capturing? Is it capturing those situations where I'm intending to avoid contact with someone that I know, and now I find out after the fact that for whatever reason it was somebody that I know? Can you speak to that, please?
Yeah, so through the chair, I guess it would depend on the specifics of the scenario. If it's a situation where someone is sort of ambiguous as to who they're engaging in sexual intercourse with, but otherwise consenting, right? If they're using sort of a first name, if they're using a code name, if they've never met, if that's sort of the thing that they're into, then I don't see this capturing that. I think what this is trying to capture is that somebody is really impersonating another physical person that is known to the victim or to the complaining witness, and thereby gets their consent. I think if they are consenting to engage in sexual contact or sexual intercourse with someone who they don't know under ambiguous circumstances, I don't know that would be captured under this particular piece of legislation.
Thank you.
Any further questions on Amendment G.6?
Yes.
Representative Eastman, let's we can allow a couple more questions, but I would love to bring this amendment to vote or unanimous consent, whichever it might be. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I'm just trying to understand the Class B portion of it, which isn't necessarily represented in the language, and how that operates, that we're now making the one crime the Class B.
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I'm sorry, I'm not sort of following that question.
All right. So I'm going back to the spoken against earlier in the document you shared, reclassify sexual contact by fraud to a Class B felony. Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to make sure I understand how that's working in the amendment.
Thank you. Through the chair, and I'm sorry I'm not totally prepared to with the document in front of me, but it should insert it into the section where it's the sexual assault in the second degree, because sexual assault in the second degree is Class B felony. And that is not otherwise in the bill, but that should be the place that it gets inserted in statute. And I can double check that. And I apologize. Okay. Like I say, I didn't have the page out in front of me.
Yeah, and if we've got a drafter available or someone who can speak to that, I'm just trying to make sure I understand the mechanism that's causing that to happen.
And we do. Claire Radford is online. Ms. Radford, if you can hear us, can you speak to how Representative Eastman's question, how the reclassification of Class B felony is occurring within Amendment G.6?
Thank you. For the record, this is Claire Radford with Legislative Legal. So what this amendment is doing is inserting a new Section 2 into the bill, and it is making sexual penetration by fraud a Class A felony. And then sexual contact by fraud is in the crime of sexual assault in the second degree, which is currently a Class B felony. So that is not changing here.
Thank you.
Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, not sure to Mr. Skidmore or Stinson. The discussion about the actual versus physical, personal, that did we, I'm not sure we closed that, or at least that I understood what we closed on as the best word. And as I was hearing all that, I was thinking we were talking about the person's true identity in just a simple sense. And I just wanted to be sure that we did close that discussion. Thank you.
Representative Tarr.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Kaufman, because I don't feel like we did. And I just want to get it out there so that if we have these individuals respond, right now we have physical identity. True and real are two other words that have been suggested. And if you notice in the sort of last line there, if the person knew the offender's real identity, so then real is actually also already used in there. So I just want that sort of among the word selection that I think people are considering right now. Physical was added to sort of address the way Mr. Stinson characterized it, but then, you know, the other conversations have taken place.
Representative Kaufman and then Representative Vance.
I only bring it up because I didn't feel we closed the deal on it, and I think we should. Thank you.
And Mr. Skidmore is now online. And Representative Vance, do you have a question? Maybe then we can go to Mr. Skidmore.
Yes, and it's about this. So the question is for Mr. Stinson. Since Representative Tarr pointed out that on line 9, the term real identity is used there, does that bring it full circle to address our question of do we need the word real up in at the on line 6 in front of the word physical identity just to solidify what we mean, or does line 9 already do that?
So through the chair, Representative Vance, if you wanted to add that qualifier to physical, I don't know that it would necessarily make an impact or not. If that could be a helpful clarification. Again, I think the reason why I personally find some comfort in the word physical is just because and correct me if I'm wrong, I actually don't think that the legislature is trying to make it a crime for someone to lie about their quote-unquote real identity or quote-unquote true identity, but what they don't want is for somebody to be impersonating another physical person that is known to the victim that typically they would have a relationship with. And so I think that's part of the tension and difficulty with writing this type of statute, and if you get into sort of the legal history of rape by fraud, it only sort of compounds some of that confusion, because sort of the philosophical underpinnings for why this originally became a crime is not connected to why we now think it's a crime. But setting that discussion aside, since I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, if you wanted to say real physical identity, I don't personally see an issue with that.
All right, thank you, Mr. Stinson.
And could Mr. Skidmore, pardon me, Mr. Chairman, just respond to that? Because I had asked for feedback from all parties, and sometimes they're different.
Yeah, absolutely. Mr. Skidmore, talking about physical identity versus actual identity versus real physical identity, please offer your thoughts.
Through the chair to Representative Tarr, this is John Skidmore for the record. The challenge with all of those different terms is that we're using terms that we haven't tried to use in our statutes before. I don't know that I can tell you one is necessarily better than another. What I have described previously is that my preference is not to use physical, but is to use actual or real, because as I think I've heard Mr. Stinson testify earlier, what I think you all as a committee were trying to get to is the idea that someone is impersonating another specific person, not that they are providing false information about themselves in terms of attributes as is described in the statute, but that they are actually pretending to be another specific person, and it's that person that we're saying there is a fraud to pretend to be that person and for the victim to think that they are that person. And that's why I look at the real or actual versus physical. But again, ultimately, real is found in another place in the statute, in the definition for the amendment that Representative Tarr pointed out. And I think a lot of this comes down to a policy call.
Mr. Skidmore, could you give an example of a scenario that would be captured under, say, actual identity that would not be captured under physical identity?
The chair, I don't know that I can come up with a hypothetical for that at this moment. I was rather trying to talk about the words that I think more accurately capture the legislature's intent. But again, you all are the legislature, so you get to decide your intent. I don't have a specific hypothetical for you, though, that will help explain that.
Okay. And I might, Mr. Stinson, would you be able, I guess, from your perspective, to speak to I'm just trying to search for the Venn diagram of what would be captured under each scenario or each wording, at least as you see it.
Yeah, so Chair Christ Tompkins, you know, reasonable minds can disagree, and I guess my fear is just that using the term actual, in my mind, could be interpreted more broadly than physical, because your actual identity isn't necessarily based on your characteristics, traits, or accomplishments. It could include, in fact, you know, a false name, other aspects. At least that's, I think, how a layperson would think of actual identity. Like if I lied to you about my name, I think you would reasonably infer that I was lying about my actual identity if you found out about that. But if you knew who I was as a physical person and knew my physical features, then obviously I couldn't be lying about that, because you can immediately observe it and know who I am, or even if I'm claiming a different name. So I guess that's sort of my hang-up. I understand what Mr. Skidmore is saying, and I agree with him, that ultimately I can't tell you with any certainty exactly which term is better. I just know that when looking at sort of the regular use of the term actual, that in my mind, in my personal opinion, seems to be broader than physical, because physical is sort of an immutable attribute that you can't lie about because it's immediately observable. So I guess that's my logic.
Any final questions from the committee? I want to take this force the question one way or the other. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And questions for Mr. Stinson through the chair. I want to get back to, I think, what is maybe the bigger question here. In this amendment, we recognize in existing law that someone can't consent to this kind of contact if they're unconscious. And so it's a very black and white situation. If you're unconscious, you can't give consent. Under this amendment, can a person give consent if they have been previously tricked concerning the physical identity of the person that they had had that contact with?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I guess I'm wondering what do you mean about previously tricked? It would be helpful for some clarification on my end.
Yes, well, in the world of criminal justice, we're talking about an event that took place in the past, and so there was the being told or being led to believe that there was one physical identity and then there was another, and so we're talking about the all the various ins and outs of whether or not this rape by fraud provision kicks in, And I'm just, is it clear in this amendment, and of course the bill, once this amendment passes, is it a black and white situation like that, where if someone is told and is led to believe one physical identity, and then it comes out after the fact that there was a different physical identity, is the person able to give consent in that situation? Are there some circumstances in which they can give consent and maybe other circumstances where they can't?
So through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there is essentially consent given under these false pretenses that would otherwise qualify as rape by fraud, and then subsequently the person decides that they want to consent to a second act now, having found out that person is a different person. Is that what you're saying?
Actually, to clarify, what I'm really getting at is lines 7, 8, and 9 of the amendment, where it talks about reckless disregard, that the person would not have consented, and that's all actions on the part of the potential offender. And what I'm talking about, to turn the tables, I'm talking about the potential victim in this situation. Are there some circumstances and situations where they could give consent because even though the potential offender is acting with reckless disregard, they actually would have consented if they had known and not been tricked? That's what I'm getting at. That's what I think is the heart of the issue here. Is this black and white, or is that also murky?
So, Representative Eastman, through the chair. So I think what gets tricky about that is it comes down to a lot of what we've discussed about how does a thing get reported. So I think, and I'm certainly not going to speak for Mr. Skidmore, but I think you'd ask the Department of Law if somebody were to sort of consent mid-act or something like that, then the question is raised whether or not they would report. I think the difficulty with framing sort of rape by fraud with an affirmative consent framework is that the idea is that they in fact did give affirmative consent, they were just tricked, right? So they've consented to the act, but only because it was by fraud or by deception. To the extent that they are undisturbed by that fraud or deception, then I think you could say technically the law would be violated. I think the question then arises, how does that ultimately get prosecuted, or how does that get reported? How does that come up to a jury? I don't know. But that's how I'm interpreting this, is that in fact, right, they're not using force or coercion. They're in fact using fraud to obtain what would otherwise be consensual sexual contact or consensual sex. It's just the person then realizes that they were in fact duped. And that's what we're trying to criminalize. And I don't know if I answered that as you liked, but I think that's probably as close as I can get.
And I'm wondering if maybe we can set this aside and just take up
take up the amendment, because I think there are any number of this is, I think, inherently tricky policy, rape by exception in any number of scenarios. So see if there's any conceptual amendment that anyone seeks to take up on amendment number 4, G.6, otherwise take up the amendment as a whole. Representative Vance.
Just thank you, you know, everyone for the conversations. I've been scribbling notes, and I think it's been really helpful. And just rereading the language as is, I like to read the language black and white, because obviously that's what attorneys will have to go on in the future. And I would make a friendly amendment to on line 6 to remove the word physical and place the word real, to have it say based on the offender's real identity. And the reason that I say that is because it aligns with the language on line 9 that says real identity. And it, I respect the recommendation for the word physical, but I feel that there could be unintended consequences by having that word there that would be overly restrictive in cases that wasn't necessarily rape by fraud. But the word real identity goes to the heart of who the person actually is, and not just physical appearance. Because as we know, physical appearance changes. It can change based upon, you know, a party, dressing up. Someone likes to wear wigs, makeup. You know what I mean? I feel like we may have...
Representative Vince, I'm just going to ask, are you making a motion?
Yes, I'm making a motion.
I'm going to object. Are there any other comments on the conceptual amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tarr.
I'll just say that when I submitted the language to Ledge Legal, it had the word true, but they chose to use the word real identity. And so just for people's consideration, because of the words that we've been discussing today.
Thank you. Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, Chair Christ-Tompkins. Since I missed the majority of this conversation, I'm wondering if that is the recommendation of the bill sponsor, if they support the amendment, and that is, I guess that's what I'm wondering.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm okay with this, and I think it's going to be a topic of further discussion, and so I'm okay with making this change today and then continuing to look at this and just make sure that there, you know, we've got it right. And I'm glad the conversation happened today, and unfortunately, I'm sorry, Rep. Story, that you missed part of it, but Mr. Skidmore and Mr. Stinson, you know, unfortunately have, you know, somewhat different viewpoints on the topic, and so it really leaves it to us. And the way I've approached this and what has been communicated to me in terms of the failure of the current statute is, you know, sort of the interpretation and what happens to jurors that have to consider the facts in those cases. And so I guess, you know, I really appreciate this conversation and discussion, because, you know, the jury of your peers, right, any one of us could be those jurors. And I think it's our, you know, we should make the best attempt to use language that, you know, we all understand means something, because it's likely then, right, that the jurors would have that same sort of perception. And that is, you know, how do we use that language in our everyday discussions, and, you know, what do we understand it to mean? So in this sense, you know, thinking about physical identity and, you know, the conversation that Mr. Stinson had, I can see why he's saying that. But if real identity sort of more like confines that, then I'm okay with that as well.
And I think at this point, my overriding concern is if we can get the bill out in final form. So I have concerns, but I'm going to remove my objection.
I'll object.
Representative Eastman.
I appreciate the first conceptual amendment. I will have one conceptual amendment as well.
Okay. Hearing no objections, conceptual amendment number 1 to amendment number 4, which is G.6, is passed, substituting real for physical on line 6. Is that correct, Representative Vance?
Yes, and I neglected to mention that we have the same language on page 2, line 4.
We'll consider that a conforming amendment and allow legislative legal to make it. Representative Eastman.
Excellent. My conceptual amendment number 2 would be to strike the word is appearing on page 2, the end of line 9. So it currently reads, with a person who is, so we would remove the word is and would insert in place of that word, would not have consented if the person knew the offender's real identity, but for the fact that they were.
Sorry, Representative, it's page 2, did you say?
So
page
we're on.
So what I'm looking at is on Amendment 1, page 6, page 1, line 6, we're talking about what happens at line 11. And so what my conceptual amendment is this, it's all the same sentence. The same sentence that picks up based on, and so rewinding towards the start of that sentence. And the full sentence would read, everything we have in Amendment 2 with the conceptual amendment and so forth. And the first part of that sentence would be, the offender engages in sexual penetration with a person who would not have consented if the person knew the offender's real identity, but for the fact that they were induced to believe by artifice, pretense, or concealment that the offender is another person. And that's where the second sentence picks up. So it's just removing one word from that sentence and inserting that clause.
I'll object. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't support that because the language that we've worked on was drafted to be in the tense that it's in, and sort of that resituates it, and I don't want to do that on the fly without time to review that. Thank you. Sorry.
Any final comments, Representative Eastman?
No, thank you.
Okay. The objection is held on conceptual amendment number 2 to amendment number 4. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Tarr?
No.
Representative Story?
No.
Representative Clayman? Representative Vance?
No.
Representative Kaufman?
No.
Representative Eastman?
Yes.
Chair Christ Tompkins?
No.
That is one yay and 5 nays.
By a vote of 1 yay and 5 nays, conceptual amendment number 2 to amendment number 4, G.6, has failed. That takes us back to amendment number 4, G.6. Before us, is there any final comment? See none. I will remove my objection.
Well, it was mine. I'll remove mine.
Oh, I'm sorry. You objected. Okay. Representative Eastman, you were removing your objection.
Yes.
Is there any further objection to amendment number 4? As conceptually amended, seeing none, amendment number 4, G.6, as conceptually amended, is adopted, and that takes us back to the bill as a whole. Are there any final comments from members other than the sponsor? Please keep them brief. Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins. I was just going to say, since I was gone, could you tell me what was changed or when we read the amendment?
Nothing else.
Nothing else. Okay. Thank you.
Further comment? Representative Eastman.
Appreciate the back and forth that we've had over several hearings on this legislation. The one thing I think we haven't attended to sufficiently is recognizing that when we place crimes into law, which we're now effectively creating a new law, you never know exactly how that's going to work. But I think one type of interaction which will cause this law to be abused is when you have otherwise innocuous events take place in the context of consenting adults, and then sometime later on, because there is no statute of limitations on this particular crime, sometimes later on that relationship sours, whether it's a marriage that ends in divorce or for some other reason, and then what was agreed by all was innocuous, though violating the letter of the law, now is used in a way that it was not intended. And so that's my main reservation.
Thank you, Representative Vance. And if you could keep your comments under a minute.
Wow, yes. I appreciate the maker of this bill coming forward and the long work that it has. There's so much that I like about this bill, but a lot that I still have a lot of reservation about, because I need a lot more understanding. So I'm committed to continue that work in the next committee and moving forward to be able to make sure that we provide the clarity needed, and just really appreciate the effort for all of the support that you have behind you in working to get here. So thank you.
Thank you. And I'll offer a final comment before we go to the sponsor and then consider a motion. I'd like to mostly associate myself with the comments of Representative Vance. Could not be a more important issue. Really want to address it. I'm concerned that rape by deception, especially with the conceptual amendment as adopted, is going to open up more unintended consequences and sort of ambiguity and prosecutorial discretion that may capture scenarios outside of the intent we've discussed. And I'm just always, I think, troubled by further steps towards sort of incarceration and mass incarceration as a solution to public safety problems, when looking at all the data from the last couple of decades, it's done very little, I think, to, well, just the overall trend lines aren't positive. So I feel like there's like these root issues that we really want to address, and that's a tough question, and I hope we can address them at some point. But I really appreciate where the bill is coming from and appreciate the sponsor's hard work. Representative Tarr.
Thank you. I do appreciate that we have tried to spend a lot of time on this. It's I wish we had more time, and I'm looking forward to the additional time in the two more committees of referral that this bill has, so it will get, it will have that additional time. And I struggle with the same issue that you made, Chair Christ Tompkins, about long prison sentences, and that's something I hope we think a lot more about. And then I also think of the statement that was very cemented in my mind, that rape is like a murder where the victim survives. And it's just the severity of the impact and the fact that it's been this longstanding problem in our state. And so I appreciate you saying it couldn't be a more important issue. And it's one of the hardest ones to address. And so, I really just appreciate everybody's hard work and thinking about it and helping me learn more, because I don't want unintended consequences. The goal here is to, improve things. But more than anything about, prison sentences is to really have opportunities to change the culture so that we move beyond, these crimes happening in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. Representative Vance. A motion? I didn't see any hands raised, but I'm also steamrolling through things. Representative Vance.
Okay. I move to report sponsor substitute for HB 5, version 32-LS0065/G, as amended, out of committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal notes, giving Legislative Legal Services the authority to make technical and conforming changes.
Hearing and seeing no objection, HB 5, sponsor substitute for HB 5 as amended, moves from committee. Thank you. And we'll be back on Thursday, and at 6:12 p.m. we are adjourned.